Hi, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for February 5th, 2026. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey, and today front page articles include FUSD updated on fraud incident, mini grants make big difference for teachers, North Country bankruptcy hearing brings optimism, and Hobbs maintains hardline approach to river water. And our first of what looks like four front page stories today is called FUSD updated on fraud incident. Superintendent says funds still remain unrecovered. And this is written by Abigail Kessler, Sun staff reporter. Flagstaff Unified School District, FUSD, Superintendent Michael Penka recently gave an update on an incident of fraud that had affected the district in the fall. In late September, the district sent a release stating it had been the victim of a financial fraud and cybercrime scheme, causing it to lose approximately $580,000. Details of the crime or how it happened were not included, though the district said it had reported the incident to several agencies and would be taking steps to enhance prevention measures. All of us are committed, both individuals and as a district, to doing better, Penka said during the meeting in late January. We've identified additional training, extra steps in our processes that can help to verify or validate before financial transactions are made that can help us prevent this type of crime from happening in the future. During the FUSD governing board meeting Tuesday, January 27th, Penka said the district has continued working with these agencies to identify the culprit and recover the funds. Agencies FUSD is working with include law enforcement, the Coconino County Treasurer, banking and audit partners, Arizona School Risk Retention and Trust Incorporated, and the State Auditor and Attorney General offices. According to Penka, the Flagstaff Police Department's investigation is ongoing and that the district has filed a claim with its insurance provider. I do remain hopeful that the district would recover those funds, Penka said. I think it would be more likely to recover them through the insurance coverage than catching the bad person and having them pay it back. I think that would be the most likely outcome. He said it was likely the funds would not be recovered by the end of the current fiscal year on June 30th. The affected money was from the District Additional Assistance under its capital fund, and Penka said should FUSD be able to recover some or all of the funds, it would then be able to apply them toward capital funding. He also said the detective working with the district has been able to identify banks where the funds were deposited and withdrawn. Though the next step in this type of crime is often to transfer money internationally. He said the detective is currently working to obtain bank records and analyze them for additional information to track the funds. The district also hired legal counsel to investigate those in the district associated with any part of the transaction and to evaluate related district practices to better respond to the risk of future crime. Panka said this investigation had determined that the district employees involved were also victims of the crime. They did not play a role in facilitating it. He added that the district has begun implementing the recommendations that came out of this process and is continuing to train its employees. They are always changing their tactics, so we have to continue to stay on the front edge of any training that's out there or any patterns that we're seeing, he said. We'll continue to do so to try to prevent this from happening in the future. Like I said, I wish I could say we caught somebody and the money's back in the district accounts. That's not where we're at right now. But we're continuing those processes to recover the funds and to prevent it from happening in the future. And that article was titled FUSD Updated on Fraud Incident by Abigail Kessler, Sun Staff Reporter. Now we'll move on to our next front page article, which also has FUSD in the title. It's called FUSD Foundation Awards Micro Grant Funding to Advance Classroom Projects in Flagstaff. And this, too, is written by Abigail Kessler, Sun Staff Reporter. Teachers at schools across Flagstaff Unified School District, FUSD, are starting efforts to enhance their students' learning through the latest round of microgrants from the FUSD Foundation. Since 2021, the FUSD Foundation has offered mini-grants, which are intended to fund special and innovative projects that enhance student outcomes, but fall outside standard school budgets, according to the Foundation website. In the most recent round, FUSD Foundation awarded grants ranging from $400 to $750 to district teachers to support their classroom projects. Those projects included replacing yoga mats at Coconino High School, new lighting across district preschool classrooms, and supporting an oral history project at Marshall Elementary. Connecting Culture, Science, and Tech. Third through fifth grade students at Loop Elementary will be completing animal research projects and presentations using styluses that third grade teacher Cheryl Benton is purchasing with her microgrant. Benton said the lesson will help students connect their understanding of Navajo cultural teachings with learning about science and technology. The students will be choosing animals to research about their names and habitats. They will then create interactive nature journals using what they've learned and will be presenting to other students and family members at the end of the project. She has been working with Navajo culture teacher Annabelle Small Canyon, fourth grade teacher Dawn Kwamahangnua, and fifth grade teacher Jolene Woody on this effort. All third through fifth grade students at Loop will be participating in some form. The whole purpose of this was to enhance student engagement and integrate technology into Navajo culture and this environment around us, Benton said. Hopefully, they get an understanding of how everything's interrelated and become aware of our surroundings and develop digital literacy and creativity in the project. The idea, she said, is to encourage students to connect what they are learning about animals and their habitats to Navajo cultural teachings, while also developing an understanding of technology and the different ways it can be utilized. Benton said students would begin working on their animal habitat projects once the styluses arrived, likely in late January. Benton said she hopes her students gain more awareness of the cultural teachings and values and how they're related to scientific understanding. She added, hopefully they'll continue teaching those values as they grow. I want the students empowered so they can use all the digital tools. Benton said she plans to continue using the styluses in her classroom and hopes to develop other enhanced lessons in future years that build on what the students have learned in previous years. Expanding access to STEM. Sanagua Middle School teacher Molly Jorelman is using her grant to support a special education science class, which she began at her school last year, called STEM Learning for All. Jorelman has been using the grant to purchase supplementary materials. The curriculum includes 4 themed lessons per month. Each unit comes with a set of vocabulary words that are incorporated into the week-long projects associated with each lesson. A total of 26 students are taking the class this school year. In December, the class created a tree by stacking Solo cups, created parachutes for Santa Claus, and made a shelf for an elf using Play-Doh and popsicle sticks. They used graph paper to draw blueprints before working in teams to construct their shelves. January's activities are snow-themed, asking students to make symmetrical snowflakes using toothpicks and marshmallows. A later lesson focuses on hibernating animals, learning about which hibernate and why, and creating hibernation stations that could keep an animal warm. Jorelman said she thinks her students have enjoyed the new curriculum and added that she plans to continue teaching the class. With my students and the kind of support that they require, I think they really enjoy this class, she said, because with STEM, there's really no right or wrong answer. It's what you think and what you want to create. They get freedom to complete a task and create what they want without me having to be like, that's incorrect. It gives them that independence and that freedom, and they don't need as much support during those times, which is good for them and their self-confidence. Let's see. Furthering language education. At Puente de Hoyo, teacher Amy Begay is using her microgrant to purchase licenses for Navajo Rosetta Stone to give her students an independent learning opportunity during near-daily Tier 2 instruction. Begay helped with the addition of Navajo to Rosetta Stone into the 2000s, working with other Navajo-speaking teachers to add language to the program. She is now hoping to use the app to add to the instruction in her classroom. saying she's been seeking funding to do so for years. She teaches both first and second grade, overseeing the half of her students' day that is taught in Navajo. She plans to use this with a group of second graders that has already met its English reading level standards during the 30 minutes of Tier 2 intervention time built into the regular school day at Puente. The microgrant funds year-long licenses for 5 or 6 students. According to Begay, she's seeking ways to implement the program more broadly in her class and school, and that Navajo Language Renaissance, the nonprofit sponsoring Navajo Rosetta Stone, has been helping with licensing and setup. Begay has ordered headsets for her students to use, as the lessons ask the students to repeat the correct pronunciation of a word or phrase. The program can then identify where the correct answer was given based on spoken input. Students move forward at their own pace, learning vocabulary, pronunciation, and grammar around topics such as greetings and introductions, shopping. The classroom has a cash register and store with assorted items to give students hands-on practice, travel, and friends. There are 8 units in the first section, which Begay said would likely take them around a school year to complete if they began at the start of the school year. She said the program gives students more consistent opportunities to hear and practice spoken Navajo language, in addition to the songs, stories, and conversations already happening in her classroom. This program will strengthen their listening and pronunciation skills, and that they can practice on their own pace too, she said. So it's going to be supporting what we're already doing in this classroom, using the language in meaningful days. Other projects that received microgrants this round included Molly Lissandrini at Mount Eldon Middle School was awarded $500 for a school-wide 8th grade effort to learn about civic engagement and activism through various art forms. Preschool coordinator Sarah Owen was awarded $500 to replace fluorescent lighting with adjustable lighting in the district's preschool classrooms. 3 teachers at Coconino High School received a microgrant this round. Francie Solarte Soto was awarded $500 to purchase novels to use in literature circles for English language learners, where Nadej Netta was awarded $400 to fill a classroom library for emerging readers. Teresa Frias received $750 to replace classroom yoga mats. Katie Krause at Marshall Elementary was awarded $500 for continued work on the HERO project, an oral history project through which Marshall students interview veterans and write and illustrate children's books based on their stories. The funds will be used to print the books. Another 3 teachers received music and arts-focused grants through the Debbie Grogan Memorial Fund with the foundation this year. And more information is available at fusdfoundation.org/teacher-grants. fusd.org/resources/#micro. And that article was called FUSD Foundation Awards Micro Grant Funding to Advance Classroom Projects in Flagstaff. And it was written by Abigail Kessler, Sunstaff reporter. Next on the front page, we have an article titled North Country Bankruptcy Hearing Brings Optimism by Sam McLaughlin, Sunstaff reporter. Attorneys for North Country Healthcare and El Rio Health expressed renewed optimism about reaching a sale agreement during a bankruptcy court hearing Monday. The change of mood from the prior hearing, when the attorneys acknowledged new and apparently unexpected objections from the federal government, was notable. A lot of progress has been made, Philip Giles, representing North Country, told Judge Daniel P. Collins. Giles said he was hopeful all parties would be prepared for the judge to rule on the motion for sale formally at the next hearing, scheduled for Tuesday, February 10th. North Country, a nonprofit community health provider operating clinics in 10 northern Arizona cities, declared bankruptcy on December 19, 2025. That followed revelations that the organization had failed to pay for employees' health insurance, leaving many with thousands of dollars in surprise medical bills, and had been cut off by key suppliers for unpaid debts. The bankruptcy filing was part of a plan for El Rio Health, another nonprofit operating 16 clinics in and around Tucson, to acquire some of North Country's assets and take over the provision of medical services at North Country's existing clinics. North Country shuttered its Bullhead City location on December 23rd, ahead of the planned transition. At the time of the original filing, Giles predicted the sale could close by February 16th. Now, however, the parties are hoping for a closing date of April 1st. The U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, on behalf of the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, had objected to some of the terms in the draft asset purchase agreement and transition services agreement. The objections raised by the DOJ were technical in nature, but unrelated to the transfer of HRSA grant funding and of North Country's Medicare billing number, and threw the timing of the sale into doubt. At the January 23rd hearing, attorneys warned that North Country was at risk of shutting down completely if the sale were significantly delayed. But on Monday, Giles and El Rio's attorney, Janelle Glynn, told the court that the federal government's objections had been effectively addressed through revisions to the transition services agreement. Louisa Solard, standing in for Lydia Gines on behalf of the DOJ, was slightly more circumspect. Our understanding is, as Mr. Giles has represented, that the changes will be helpful in resolving our objection, Solard said. Giles and Glynn also said Governor Katie Hobbs' office had taken notice of the potential public health crisis that could occur if North Country failed, and had offered to expedite the transition of licenses and contracts. We are aware of the situation and have been closely monitoring it, Hobbs's press secretary, Liliana Soto, told the Arizona Daily Sun. Ensuring that patients in northern Arizona maintain access to primary and specialty care is critically important to the governor. We've set up some meetings, and Access and ADHS, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, and the Arizona Department of Health Services stand ready to expedite the change of ownership processes to ensure the administrative paperwork doesn't get in the way of the provision of health care up there, Soto said. Within the bankruptcy process, North Country received a $1 million loan from the Narba Institute and Northern Arizona Healthcare to keep paying employees and vendors. Stephen D. Jerome, the attorney representing Narba, told the court, "We now have a little bit more optimism than perhaps I had at the last hearing. I was feeling a little glum after the last hearing myself," Collins replied. Collins asked Giles if North Country, if North Country will be able to hold on until the new projected closing date. Despite the loss of Medicare payments, currently withheld because North Country failed to file its mandatory end-of-year cost report on time, Giles said the latest budget projections using data from the month of January were somewhat better than expected. "It does look like we can make it to the end of March," he said. Multiple employees have alleged that North Country has been conducting layoffs since the start of the calendar year, possibly in an attempt to further reduce operating costs. The total number of employees affected has not been confirmed. In between the January 23rd and February 2nd hearings, Collins signed orders allowing North Country to break its leases on the former clinic in Bullhead City and the now vacant administrative offices on Cortland Boulevard in Flagstaff. That, too, should provide at least some reduction in expenses. Former CFO pushes back on CEO's claims. In a status report filed with the court on February 3rd, Giles repeated a claim previously made by North Country CEO Ann Newland, an error in the company's 2022 Medicare cost report resulted in $1.2 million in overpayments that had to be paid back. Newland's previously filed declaration and Giles' status report attributed this error to the former chief financial officer, James Gross, and alleged it was the catalyzing event of an eventual systemic problem, ultimately resulting in bankruptcy. Gross told the Arizona Daily Sun that he did make an error, but doesn't believe his mistake is to blame for the organization's subsequent trajectory. "There was one line item that should have been the sum of two numbers, and I only included one number. Huge mistake. It was a $1 million mistake," Gross said. "Biggest mistake ever made in my career. I own that error, 100%, he continued. But at the time, there was money in the bank, in our cash reserves, that we could have paid that off with. He noted that the debt, though substantial, was small compared to the organization's annual revenue of roughly $60 million at the time. Had the operations gone forward in a positive manner, there would have been no bankruptcy, he added. Gross said he believes his error makes him an easy target for blame. But he contends that other financial decisions made before, during, and after his time with the company, from July 2022 to February 2024, deserve equal scrutiny. I tried my best to be the guardrail that I was supposed to be, and I just wasn't being listened to, he said. Newland, he added, was always the final decision maker, something other former high-level employees have also asserted. And that article was titled, North Country Bankruptcy Hearing Brings Optimism, by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff Reporter. And just a reminder that you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print materials due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also get our stream and on-demand programs with the new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. And now we're getting to our fourth front page article today. This one is a state and regional article, and it is titled, Hobbs and Bouchatsky Maintain Arizona's Hardline Approach to Colorado River Water. And this is written by Howard Fisher at Capital Media Services. Governor Katie Hobbs said Monday that unless upper basin states actually offer up some firm commitments to conserve water, she won't agree to any deal for Arizona to cut its own withdrawals from the Colorado River. And that would lead to either Interior Secretary Don Burgum imposing his own solution on the seven states drawing water from the river, and from the situation having to be hashed out in court. The only thing is that Burgum has so far refused to do more than bring the governors of the affected states together, as he did on Friday. And Terry Goddard, president of the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, which oversees the state's Colorado River supply, said the options put forward by the Interior Department are not palatable to Arizona or California, one of the other two lower basin states. All Burgum's done is set us up for litigation, he told Capital Media Services, and I think that's sad. Hobbs in November had asked Burgum to get involved and develop a plan designed to protect Arizona water users, specifically by requiring conservation in the upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah. But on Monday, she did not dispute that so far, even during Friday's meeting, all he has done is encourage states to work together. Still, the governor said she thinks it doesn't necessarily have to wind up in court, even though Arizona already has set aside $3 million for litigation. While we didn't leave with a lot of specifics, the details are to be worked out through negotiation. I think that we came away with hearing that nobody wants to end up in litigation, Hobbs said. We want to find a way to get to a deal. But Hobbs said that means recognizing that Arizona, which already has agreed to give up 27% of the water it has been getting from the Colorado River, won't give up a drop more unless there are firm and enforceable promises that the upper basin states will share in the burden. That theme was echoed by Tom Buschatsky, director of the State Department of Water Resources. We need certainty that there are reductions in upper basin usage, because that is one of two tools that we have, he said. What with historic drought conditions, meaning less water is going into the river upstream. You can't make it snow or rain, Buschatsky said, but you can reduce your demand. So that has to be a tool that's in play at some level. At the heart of it is the need to cut Colorado River usage, with some estimates showing that consumption of river water needs to be cut by up to 3.2 million acre feet a year. That's enough to serve more than 9 million homes. The lower basin states of California, Nevada, and Arizona have agreed to trim usage by 1.5 million acre feet, enough to serve about 4.5 million homes a year. And Arizona, which contractually and legally has the lowest priority claims to river water, has to cut its own withdrawals from what it's been allowed by 27%. Upper basin states have said they're willing to voluntarily conserve water, meaning more would flow down the river to the lower basin states. But Hobbs noted that has yet to be put into an actual commitment. I shared this with Secretary Burgum and the other basin states, the governor said. For a successful negotiated outcome, Arizona and the lower basin cannot and will not be balancing the Colorado River on our own. She said lower basin states are willing to do more only if our partners in the upper basin states come to the table with reductions of their own. That, in turn, leads to the prospect of having all this decided in court. The stonewalling from the upper basin has made it very hard to see a non-litigation course in the future, Goddard said. If the upper basin continues to say, in a time of shortage, we're not going to save and contribute to the shortage one drop of water, I don't see we can have a settlement. How much Arizona can demand could depend, at least in part, on the other lower basin states all hanging together. Cooperation has not always been the rule, with California at times exercising the fact it holds more senior water rights. And even now, the amount of water that Arizona has offered up, about 760,000 acre feet, is, on a per capita basis, more than California. But Hobbs believes that despite California's senior right to the water, the state's western neighbor won't sell Arizona down the river, so to speak, to protect its own water interests. She said all three lower basin states have been united since they came to an agreement among them in 2023. So I feel very confident that we are continuing on a united path to get where we need to be on the Colorado River, the governor said. I think we always have to be cautious, said Goddard, a former state attorney general, acknowledging that, compared to California, Arizona has a slightly lower pecking order. And he acknowledged the history between the two states. Keep your friends close, Goddard said. But we've had some very good discussions with the major water users in California, he continued. They have a joint interest with us. We are all part of a growing economy in the West that gets its water from the Colorado River. That hasn't stopped Hobbs from making what she says is the case for why Arizona, despite its lower priority on taking Colorado River water, should have its needs met, and why the Trump administration should pay special attention. The most important computer chip manufacturing facilities in the Western Hemisphere are here in Arizona, critical to winning our struggle against China in the AI arms race and at the center of the president's recent trade deal in Taiwan, Hobbs said. And then there's the fact that the majority of the nation's winter crops are grown in Arizona. And the title of this article was called Hobbs and Bouchotsky Maintain Arizona's Hardline Approach to Colorado River Water. And this was written by Howard Fisher, Capital Media Services. Now we'll move off the front page and read a few local stories. First one we'll read is called NACASA Continues Offering Forensic Medical Exams by Abigail Kessler, Sun Staff Reporter. Northern Arizona Care and Services After Assault, NACASA, is continuing to offer forensic medical exams and other services in Flagstaff following a leadership transfer last month. In late December, NACASA announced it had moved to operate under the joint leadership of Northern Arizona Healthcare, NAH, and Victim Witness Services for Northern Arizona, VWS, as of December 15, 2025. The program was first started in 2002 and had been run by North Country Healthcare, NCHC, since 2008. NCHC is currently going through a bankruptcy filing and potential sale. NACASA said its change in leadership means that the decision or led to the decision to move the program was made over the summer. VWS NACASA program manager Danielle Hoagland and clinical coordinator Katrina McKittick said the program is continuing to provide the same services it had before the transition and that these are being offered in Flagstaff. Accessing NACASA's services is now primarily through a 24/7 crisis line handled by VWS. Those calling the line will be immediately connected to an advocate who can help with scheduling, answer questions, and connect them to other local resources as needed. Program leaders are working on developing a new website for NACASA. In the meantime, the website used under its previous leadership can be used. The hotline number is 928-856-7676, and the current website can be accessed at northcountryhealthcare.org. mycountryhealthcare.org/community-programs/sexual-assault-support. Exams are offered every day of the year between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. in a dedicated clinic space overseen by NAH in Flagstaff. NACASA's nurse examiners have remained the same after the transition, and the program has added a new medical director, Dr. Hannah Fox. NACASA offers transportation assistance to residents in rural areas, and it noted that other services are available in the northern Arizona region. The crisis line also connects people to these resources if they would be more readily accessible to them, and, it said, patients do not need to travel to Phoenix to receive care. NACASA can provide medical forensic exams and medical care to anyone 13 and older who are victims of domestic violence, strangulation, or sexual assault. Those younger would be directed to NAH's Safe Child Center instead. The hotline refers people to this resource as needed. Its services are available to men and women, and those seeking services do not need to be 100% sure they have been assaulted. Having an exam is not required. According to Hoagland and McKittick, NACASA is meant to be a place where people can discuss treatment and response options without being pushed in a particular direction. Advocates are available to answer questions, and exams can be scheduled after taking time to think things over. And that article was titled NACASA Continues Offering Forensic Medical Exams by Abigail Kessler, Sun Staff Reporter. Our next story is called Helios Education Foundation makes $2.5 million investment in NAU by Daily Sun staff. Northern Arizona University announced that it had received a $2.5 million investment from the Helios Education Foundation over the next 3 years. This funding is intended to expand equitable access for students and provide wraparound support to advance academic momentum, according to the release. Efforts related to the gift are expected to begin soon. Helios has been an extraordinary partner in advancing NAU's efforts to ensure that students not only access college, but also persist, graduate, and excel in their careers, said NAU President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera. This investment strengthens the student-centered programs and services that define NAU education, supporting students as they complete their degrees and prepare for meaningful careers that contribute to Arizona's workforce and economy. The funding will provide one-time Helios Access and Persistence scholarships for low-income Arizona residents. Scholarship recipients will be awarded up to $3,000 to cover costs other than tuition, such as housing, meals, and past due balances. The scholarships will be open to eligible NAU students starting in fall 2026. Building on the university's commitment to Arizona resident students, these new funds from Helios will extend support to room and board expenses, which can hinder progression toward degree completion. said NAU President, Vice President of Student Affairs, Margot Saldanstall. Thanks to Helios and their investment in the Helios Access and Persistence Scholarships, more than 40 lower-income Arizona students will receive funds to assist in addressing housing and/or meal plan costs and help ensure that completing their degree is not interrupted. The funding will support the Arizona Institute for Education and the economy's hiring a full-time AI or A1, I'm not sure, director, and an education innovation director who will guide the Arizona AI or A1 Alliance and the H5 High School Redesign Coalition. And that article was called Helios Education Foundation Makes $2.5 million Investment in NAU. And that's written by Daily Sun staff. And next up, we're going to read a column called The Long and Winding Road, Too Much Ice Tries to Freeze Out Goodness. This is written by columnist Mary Tolan. Never ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble. Representative John Lewis, 2018. I grew up in Wisconsin, its western border leaning against Minnesota. As a college student, I lived for a year in the Twin Cities on an exchange program in St. Paul. I was also exploring a romance with my first serious boyfriend, a law student at University of Minnesota. I loved this state where people often seemed happier than depressed, a citizenship of let's do it, despite the howling wind and freezing cold temperatures. There was a clarity in the air, a cold embrace of what felt like, to my 20-year-old self, mostly goodness. Now those good Minnesotans are showing up by the thousands to push back against a government immigration program that pits war-armed, face-covered U.S. agents against immigrants as well as United States citizens who are protesting in the streets. We all know by now that two such protesters, Americans Renee Good and Alex Preddy, were shot dead in two separate incidents by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, ICE, both 37 years old, both white. Good and Preddy were protesting and bearing witness to actions of ICE in support of immigrants and neighbors. Good was shot inside her own vehicle, a Honda Pilot, for gosh sakes. Preddy, when he was helping a woman who had been shoved to the ground by ICE officers. He was legally armed, but did not take out his gun before being shot to death. After both shootings, the administration immediately called the victims horrible names and pretended that we, the American people, could not see what actually happened, but we did see. A friend recently loaned me a book called The Postcard by Anne Berest, a French novelist. It's about World War II in France and the tactics of the Nazis and other Hitler defenders. It tells stories of neighbors who turn in neighbors, as well as the strength of people who resist. Berest tells the story of a Jewish family of immigrants who do everything right to become French citizens. After years of following a script for success, they end up in hiding, and finally in Auschwitz. You find out about their fate in the first pages of the books, so no spoilers here. As I read this incredible story while consuming the news in this country, I could not ignore the parallels. the French Jews grabbed from the street or from their homes or places of worship by Nazis because of their religion, their culture, their appearance, they are disappeared. Some 80 years later, people of color, any color but white in America, including a 5-year-old boy and other children, snatched from the streets, from school or store parking lots, hospitals, and even from their homes, where the front doors are bashed in by ICE, all encouraged by the leadership in Washington, D.C. People disappeared once more. Another parallel, the fear. Jewish families in France and elsewhere, of course, were afraid to leave their homes, to venture outside. They curled themselves into hidden compartments in cars to cross borders for allegedly better lives. Then they had to hide again, afraid of more raids, double crossings, and deaths. In this country, shades are drawn tight as people don't leave their homes and many keep their children out of school, so afraid are they to be seen in public. From what I understand, most who voted for this president wanted illegal immigrant criminals removed from this country, not 5-year-old boys, not pregnant mothers shoved to the ground, not crime-free immigrant workers who keep our economy going. They did not vote for raging ICE officers savaging innocent people with impunity. Minnesotans are showing us the way. They are shopping for strangers who live in fear for their lives. They are walking other people's children to school. Little kids whose parents are afraid they will be picked up and deported, leaving their youngsters abandoned. This is happening in the Twin Cities and around the country. When will ICE leave Minnesota and enter another blue state? While so many Europeans protected and hid the Jews who were being persecuted, many sold them out for their own gains. And while many Americans are rallying to the call of goodness of the Constitution, others still believe all immigrants are bad. People of darker shades of skin are to be shunned or worse, and the only color that is good is white. And whites who defend the others lock them up, or worse, obviously. I'm following the news from a distance, and I'm upset. A friend in St. Paul tells me her and all her friends' nerves are shot. The sounds of helicopters, whistles, the protesters use, the speeding ICE SUVs in once peaceful neighborhoods, and these deaths put everyone on edge. This Midwestern takeover is tied to politics, of course. Minnesota has not elected a Republican president since 1972. Remember that guy? Richard Nixon. Whoops. Bruce Springsteen and others are writing songs protecting the ICE raids. Whatever the outcome from these latest killings on the streets of America, the whole country is watching. The whole world is watching. And that column was written, was called The Long and Winding Road, Too Much ICE Tries to Freeze Out Goodness. And this is written by columnist Mary Tolan. And that's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and take care.